188 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Tihi Mission of Aesthetics 189. Of Rational Development. A home in which dissension reigns attracts to itself a soul equally discordant. When upon reach immaturity, such a soul exhibits the traits of its parents, such traits are erroneously ascribed to the previous generation by such as do not realize that each evolving consciousness has its own definite temperament and does not receive its tempera, mental bias from another. The collective attitudes of nations, generations, and races result in their drawing into objective manifestation all subjective qualities consistent with their own. When a nation gives itself over chiefly to problems of finance, souls who conceive money to be of primary importance incarnate therein until ultimately the entire fabric of that people is permeated with this common attitude. Souls in whom corresponding interests do not exist depart from such people and either appear in other races or else in anticipation of a better day resign themselves to patience. If we truly wish to beautify our present civilization, we must realize the necessity of creating an environment which will draw into objective manifestation the nobler souls whose rational faculties have been unfolded to a comprehension of the harmonious and the good. This same environment will further stimulate to rationality those who have not yet fully achieved to this exalted state. Philosophy was the dominating passion of ancient Greece, and so intense was its attractive power that it drew into incarnation the greatest number of noble thinkers the human race has ever produced. If we would endure as a great people, we too must realize that as qualities increase in excellence, they also increase in permanence, and that a civilization established upon virtue, beauty, and utility will endure long after the structures erected upon the foundations of finance and war have vanished from the earth. Today the philosopher in search of reality must retire deep into the recesses of his inner self and thus escape from the discordances of the outer life. If he would think, he must depart from the mob which in its non-productive scrambling scatters the faculties of the mind and robs man of his most precious gift, the power of thought. It should not be necessary for man. 190 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. To leave the world in order to find himself, for his world should be a place where his true nature may mingle in concord with the true natures of all other beings. The sham of civilization is apparent when we realize that it forces the majority of people to assume false lives, to live in conflict with their inner convictions. The idealist must keep silent or be reviled, the thinker must hold his peace or be persecuted, the mystic dares not share his vision with the world, which, though aware that he is right, will crucify him if not in body at least in soul. Hence, those with little knowledge babble continuously and their words become the laws of men, while those of nobler vision must remain unknown, unhonored, and unsung. Never can we rise to the true height seen by the eyes of the idealist while we are in servitude to the inferior part of ourselves. Man does not realize the weight of that curse by which he was cast forth from the light of truth to wander in the darkness of his own making. He feels helpless in the presence of the vast industrial mechanism which has required centuries for its perfection and which has now assumed an appearance so formidable that even those who consider themselves its masters tremble and are afraid. Philosophy knows that before man can really live, the machine must go, and if humanity is incapable of self-emancipation, it must wait until the mechanism grinds itself to pieces. It is predestined that the golden age shall come again, that men shall live together in love and understanding, and the earth shall become once more a garden of surpassing beauty as it was in the beginning. In that time men shall learn all that they learn now. There shall be great institutions for research. And record, the arts and crafts shall flourish. But unlike preceding generations, this era shall not pass away, for the God of it shall be beauty and wear beauty in its various aspects. Rules a people, that people shall remain as permanent as etern. ity. It is not necessary that we tear down the entire structure of our present system or revert to some savage type and start anew. It is merely necessary that we tincture utility with Tihi mission of aesthetics 191. Beauty, that we add the soul qualities of symmetry and grace to the products of our schemings. Beauty is the deadly enemy of every excess, for into its constitution enter the elements of grace, proportion, symmetry, and harmony. A thousand means have been suggested by which the injustice of men may be offset, but all these must ultimately fail unless aesthetics becomes an integral part of our social fabric. Until the soul reaches that degree of rationality wherein it is able to recognize the supreme importance of the beautiful, it cannot withstand the urge of selfishness and greed, which ever lure nations as well as individuals to their destruction. When we love the beautiful as we now love the dollar, we shall have a great and enduring civilization. When we adore the God of harmony as we once worshipped the God of vengeance, we shall know the inner mystery of life. When we create with symmetry, preserve with integrity, and release with joy, then only are we good. Never until we have become one with the good can we be happy, for happiness is the realization of internal beauty which joyously goes forth to mingle itself with the beauty that dwells in space. The ladder of life. Man is ever ascending from an inferior to a superior state according to a law which was established coeval with the foundation of generation. This law is Shi Ti, philosophic ladder, which is treated more in detail in chapter 17. It is a Qlise, the mysterious Masonic ladder, that ancient symbol of the secret work. Chapter 9. Theical of any society. W hat relationship does the little life we know bear to that vaster existence which is our hope and which Rabelais would call the great perhaps? Three questions have ever vexed the rational faculties of mankind. Life is the beginning of what? Love is the fulfillment of what? Death is the end of what? The essential attribute of an enduring religion or philosophy is the rational solution which it offers to this threefold riddle. If physical existence be regarded as the whole of life, then the hopelessness and inconsistency of the scheme is apparent, for as Manilius writes, we begin to die as soon as we are born, and the end is linked to the beginning. Hence universal order can only be restored when we regard physical existence as a fragment of a nobler and more complete cycle of duration. Somewhere in the chain of his speculation, the philosopher will ask, is the corporeal state natural or accidental to man? In other words, is man destined by virtue of inherent qualities to abide forever as a terrene creature, or is he like the hero of that Gnostic classic, the hymn of the robe of glory, an exiled prince seeking the way which leads back to his father's kingdom, the spiritual Don Land? Knowledge of the purpose of life is essential to right living. Unless we comprehend, in part at least, the order of which we are a minute but consequential part, we cannot achieve the greatest good here and now. The past and future, like mighty trees, meet overhead and shadow the present. The field of today's endeavor is bounded on the one hand by unborn tomorrow and on the other by dead yesterday. Our attitudes toward these opposites, the fateful past and the destined future, must be the measure of our present achievements. When 193-194 lectures on ancient philosophy, He says, the present only is great, the past is dead, the opportunist little realizes that he himself is the past, for all that goes before lives again in that which follows after. The today man worships is but a fleeting second, yesterday was without beginning, and tomorrow without end, yet all are embraced within the span of the eternal philosophic now. From the obscure fountains of futurity the waters of time flow down through the turbulent cataracts of present endeavor to mingle finally with the boundless ocean of the past. All men worship either life or death. Philosophers worship life by affirming it to be imperishable, the non-philosophic worship death by accepting it as a reality. Being essentially incorporeal, life is not limited to place, but in the terms of Neoplatonism is everywhere, not with interval, but impartibly. In his Auxiliaries to the Perception of Intelligible N.A. Tours, Porphyry tells us that things essentially incorporeal are not locally present with bodies, but are present with them when they please, by verging toward them so far as they are naturally adapted so to verge. They are not, however, present with them locally, but through habitude, proximity, and alliance. Being free from the limitations of place, used in its Platonic sense, life animates forms by approaching them, and by its subsequent withdrawal into its own nature causes the forms to exhibit the phenomenon called death. In its physical sense, life results from the temporary association of an incorporeal agent with a corporeal patient. Bodies, being corporeal, occupy place, and an interval exists between them regardless of their apparent proximity. When life which exists without such interval animates form, an illusion is created which causes the uninformed to assume that life itself is subject to the confining bounds of place. Being incorporeal, the gods were not limited to place but exercised their aeonic privilege of being distributed according to will throughout the entire substance of creation. This explains the popular belief that God is everywhere and hence with equal efficiency may be addressed by multitudes in various places simultaneously. While life is essentially ethereal and in constant activity, form is essentially dense and static. In calm